This is the Finding Mastery podcast, and I am Michael Gervais. And in these conversations, we're going to sit down with people who are on the path of mastery. And what basically that means is that they're either touch mastery or they're hungry to understand it. And the goal of the conversations is to identify their psychological framework, which is how they see themselves and how they understand how the world works, and also understand the robust and sturdy practices that allow them to explore their potential. And in the case of this conversation, explore the potential of others. And in essence, the end game hope is to provide you with ways that you can train your mind and your craft in a very similar fashion to some of the world's exceptional performers. And we're just going to pull back the curtain and see if we can get some deep clarity on what those practices look like. And in this episode, it's with Dave Phillips. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
And Dave is a world-leading coach. He has a global perspective of what world-leading coaching looks like. He's traveled the world. He's lived in many, many different countries, as we talk about. And he himself has made, as an expert coach, he's made golf's top 100 teachers since 2000. And he's also recognized by Golf Digest as one of the top 50 coaches in the U.S. And maybe more importantly in this conversation, he's taken the insights of his craft and turned it into a wonderful business to be able to accelerate the coaching craft inside of golf. So he spent 25 years working how to really understand how to teach others how to excel. And so this is, I'm excited because this is about coaching and this is about expert coaching. And the most important coach we have is the coach within ourselves. Our inner dialogue, the conversation we have with ourselves is either creating glass ceilings and structures to not go for it, or it's creating opportunities to take a shot and take a risk and work hard and stay with it. And so we are our most important coach. And that's essentially, I think, one of the really robust strategies that we'll learn here. And so as a co-founder of the Titleist Performance Institute with Dr. Greg Rose, really what they've done is it's a game changer in the field of golf. And their goal was to be the first true golf performance facility that wrapped around as many players that they could, and to really wrap around the entire person, for everything from game strategy to equipment to biomechanics, and a rich and deep look at the human body. And so since they started their seminars in 2006, they've now certified over 17,000 coaches in 59 countries across the world. So there's incredible gems inside of this, and there's really rich strategies that that he is able to articulate. As you listen, I hope you'll hear how he thinks about the importance of surrounding ourselves, all of us, with people that are deeply interested in the collective success of the group. And that's both personally and professionally, to have people in our lives that have our backs and are truly supporting us and challenging us in just the right way. He talks through the importance of being curious, and he himself, that's his framework. He's really curious about how things work. And then he looks for themes and he structures those themes and passes it on to others. He talks about the importance of learning from failure and just not getting caught up in the pain that comes with it, but learning from it, taking the essence of it and moving forward quickly. And, you know, he also talks about how he helps others to take risks. And he's a risk taker himself. And I hope you enjoy that journey that he walks us through. And the essence, I think, from a collective group of helping others become, is he really reinforces the idea to make sure that we take a look at the foundation of going for it, which is really how we surround ourselves with people that support us, that challenge us, that understand us, so that we can do the same for them, and the collective becomes something greater than any individual could experience on their own. So that's what he represents. Those are some of the strategies that maybe you can employ in your own life. And enough of this intro. Let's get right into this with Dave Phillips.
Dave, welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm jacked to have you on here. I'm excited to get going on this. And I just shared a bit of your history and what you've been up to. But can you just bring us up to speed to kind of what you got going on nowadays?
Sure. First of all, Michael, thanks so much for having me on. It's been amazing to listen to the podcast that you've done already. You've had some incredible people on there that I learned from, and I hope to continue learning, and I'm excited to be on with you. But in terms of TPI and what we do, you know, I'm a golf professional by training, I suppose. I grew up all over the world, had an interesting childhood, and grew up in Africa and Asia and the Middle East, Far East. I lived in 27 different countries. And the place to learn golf was those, in a lot of these third world countries, the safest place for a young kid is actually the country club. So everybody joins it regardless of whether they play golf or not. And I learned to play at a young age and got a crash course in lots of different cultures, which has really helped me. And, you know, over the years, learning golf, becoming a good player, and really searching to try and be a great player has kind of led me to meet some incredible people, some incredible players and coaches, and I continue to play at the highest level I can, but my passion is really coaching, and that's what we do here at TPI.
And then awesome. And how did it turn from playing to coaching? Where did that rub happen for you?
You know, I think I got a college scholarship to play golf, and I was a soccer player. And you know, it was one of those things where I really didn't know, coming from a different world. You know, I grew up in Africa and went to 13 different high schools and traveled all over. And I really didn't know the culture of American college life or anything like that. And I was kind of out of my element. I was very young, for one. I came to America when I was 17 years old, actually 16. I graduated college when I was 19, so went through it very quickly. But, you know, I think what happened was I wanted to be like most young kids. You know, you get involved with the sport. I wanted to be the next great golfer. I wanted to win the Masters, you know. And so that was my passion. That's what I wanted to do. And I was good. I was a good player as a junior, and I played in a lot of different events. And through college, I played, and then I started to realize that I never had any formal coaching, and I just was one of these kids that would watch people and copy them, and I was good at it, to the point where my golf pro, I remember in Africa, had an artificial hip, and he used to kick his leg in order to be able to turn on the backswing. So as a young kid, I had this little kick in and turn. And people would stop me and go, "Why do you do that?" And I just said, "Well, that's what you do, isn't it?" And actually worked. But you know, people were like, "Well, you don't need to do that." And actually, this pro said to me once, he goes, "Why are you doing what I do?" And I go, "Well, that's what you do, you know." And but as kids, I mean, that's what you kind of do. You don't have all these layers of paint on the house. You just look and you see something you like and you get engaged, and that's what's so important. And in a big circle, I think that's where coaching in many ways needs to go back to. It needs to go back to these kids. But I think for me, I was in search. You know, when I got over here, it was this world. You know, everybody wanted to be in America. Everybody wanted to go to America. When you're an expat or where you live in another country, you can't believe how great this country is. And, you know, when you come from other countries, you know, the fact that people here complain about anything, I'm like, how can you complain? You have no idea. In Africa and Asia and what's going on in some parts of the world today, it's still the greatest country in the world. And the opportunities are incredible. And I just was like this wide-eyed kid that had all this opportunity. And I started doing, I didn't know how to become a golf professional or how to get to the next level. I really didn't have the support structure of a family. So I just searched, and I found somebody that said, "Hey, you should join the PGA of America. You know, that's how you start." So I did, and you know, got a first job at like a country club up in northern New Jersey at the time, and you know, thought this was it. This is how you became a golf pro. And then there was the business of golf, and then there was the golf shop and all that stuff, which really didn't interest me. I wanted to be a player, and so I found my way really just by, you know, watching other players and trying and learning and going to different teachers and so on and so forth. But I think what really happened for me and why I didn't get to that next level is perhaps because I was too inquisitive. I was searching too much. And from what I've learned today in the role I am here, you know, the very best players in the world, they know what they're good at. They don't necessarily worry about what other people are good at. And I think I did. And I think that's probably what hurt me to get to the next level, but hey, I found my calling anyway. I love to coach and teach.
Yeah. Okay. I heard so many important things in there. Like you've talked about gratitude. You talked about your strength becoming a liability at some point, and how some of the best in the world actually are really good at controlling what's in their control and gating out all the other noise that comes down the, you know, that floods them on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And then I heard something else, which is, did you say 13 high schools?
Yes, yes. It was, you know, I was born in England, and my parents kind of went to Africa when I was about 6-7 months old, and I grew up in Kenya, and then through the school systems, you know, we basically hopped from country to country every 3 or 4 months. So I was all over Africa. I was in the Middle East, the Far East. I was in Asia. I ended up in Papua New Guinea, a small island above Australia. My parents eventually immigrated to Australia. And they were bouncing backwards and forwards between there and Africa. And then I was at an age where I was like, I need to get out. I need to escape. And there's this big country. I came here on vacation in 1979 to America, and I was just amazed. I think what got me the most was the amount of food you got when you stopped at a restaurant. It was just insane, and the size of the cars. I was like, look at that car. It's like you could sleep in there. It was bigger than my house. So that just amazed me, and that kind of led me to say, hey, I want to come here. I was in Africa at the time. I have an older brother and sister that they went to Australia, and my parents wanted me to go there, and I basically said, no, I'm going to America. So,
okay, and what did mom and dad do that had you, you know, uprooted every 3 to 4 months?
You know, I think it's been a mystery. No, it's my father was in the telecommunications industry.
Is that what he called it?
That's what he called it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, so dad was doing his thing. You're not sure exactly what it is. Like, we can leave a lot to imagination with that.
Yeah.
And was bringing the family with him.
Yes.
So what was it like? Okay, I've got this idea in my head that there's key events and, you know, and people, that either events or people deeply influence our path. And this has got to be one of them, but I don't want to presume that. I don't want to assume that this was the event that shaped your life. But moving every 3 to 4 months, having to figure out how to be the new kid on a regular basis had to be really challenging. But I'm sure it built some resiliency. But I want to learn.
It was, yeah. I think that was probably it, is that I was always the new kid and I had to make friends fast. And I was very good at copying. So even language, like, you know, not that I know a lot of different languages, but I could change dialects. You know, I could go from a very kind of South African tone to my voice, you know, to a very Australian slang to, you know, wherever I was, I would just mimic people quickly because I knew that if I didn't, I would get beaten up or it would be more difficult to get by. And then sport, you know, sport was that defining factor in that I played everything. I played cricket. I played rugby. I played soccer. I played golf. Anything that there was sport, I was in. And that kind of breaks down a lot of barriers. You know, when you're part of a team, people get to realize that you're serious. And if you were good, which fortunately I came from a pretty athletic family, I fit in very quickly. So that was what was really cool.
I hear this often, that sport is like this common language. The ball speaks to everybody. And if we hold that thought for a minute, what was it like for you to, like, how did you figure out how to fit in? I know you use sport, but then how did you figure out as a 12-year-old, 14-year-old, how to fit into a new environment? And I'll tell you why I'm curious about this, is because that skill of being able to adapt and adjust has been my understanding of what the most creative, the most adapt, the highest functioning athletes and performers are able to do. They get out so far away from the pack that they're forced to adjust and adapt and really sometimes very rugged environments.
Well, yeah, you know, I was very much the odd one out most of the time. And I think the big thing for me was having an incredible awareness of my surroundings. And you know, when you live in a third world country, there's a lot of things going on that you need to be aware of. And so I think that was the biggest thing, is not only did I have a great perspective of my surroundings, I was aware of myself in those surroundings. So, you know, and it took a long time for me to learn, but you know, this is what I notice even with elite level athletes today. You know, the ones that succeed the best, and especially under pressure, they tend to be able to separate themselves from the situation. It's almost like they've got an out-of-body experience where they can see things from a higher perspective than everybody else. And then they dive back in. And I think that was me from a young age, you know.
So what do you think it was about your upbringing that propelled you or led you to this path of really understanding the mechanics of teaching people how to help others be great golfers, as well as building that business, the business that you have?
Well, you know, I think you have to be inquisitive. You have to want to know. And, you know, I think the other big things that are important, you know, obviously, you know, and I mentioned to you, I have this talk on the F's, which we could get into, F words. But, you know, family and friends and having a supportive family structure, you know, having an older brother that was really good at everything. And I was the little brother that wasn't. It drove me harder. And I see that today, and that, you know, even in golf with young kids, is that if there's an older sibling or an older friend or somebody better, if you can keep that kid in the game, they'll actually become better. And I think in many ways that was me, you know.
So, okay, when we go back to thinking about what you're driven for, was it to be better, or was it to be better than that kid or that brother?
Like, it wasn't so much that. It was to be accepted. In order to be accepted, I had to be as good, if not better.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your drive early on was to be as good or better than others, as opposed to the way I understand your, like what you do now is helping people not necessarily be the best in the world, but get better, which is that process of improvement.
Yeah. So I think what I noticed is that in order to, even at a young age and coming here to America, not knowing anybody, just going to school and getting indoctrinated into the whole college world and so on and so forth, I think that you're surrounding yourself with people that you respect and then learning from them. And, you know, what we've done at TPI is, you know, when we started, we built an advisory board of 52 men and women that are way smarter than us. And so what was important to me was find the best and ask them if they'll help. And most people will. And, you know, if you can get them to be on your advisory board, if you don't know the answer, you can go find it, because someone's going to have bumped into someone. It's a small world when you really get to that level, you know.
And at what disciplines did you pull together on that board? So this is the beginning of your business, right?
It is. Yeah. So, you know, when TPI started, it was really Greg and I, and you know, we were in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I was a golf professional at a country club where I was the teacher, and I taught, you know, anybody from beginning golfers to members to high-level tour players. And basically what happened was I had heard about this guy in Washington, D.C. that had this biomechanics background. You know, he used to look at the human body and he was working with golfers. And it was a rainy day and I took one of my students down there and he took me through this assessment of the physical side. So I had never really thought of that. I mean, as many golfers, when you learn golf, you pick up a club and the first thing you want to do is hit the driver as far as you can. And you know, it wasn't until, you know, Greg really made me aware that you need to understand what that body's capable of, because there's lots of ways to swing the club. I mean, our philosophy in golf is there's thousands of ways to swing the club, but there is an efficient way for each of you, but it's based on what you can physically do. So you need to know what you're capable of first.
I want to pause there. So what you're capable of. So the way that I think about this is, I use the word like, what is that person's potential? And I like what you just did with, I think we're talking about the same thing. I obviously will see this from a psychological perspective, and you're going to see, you're right now you're talking about looking at it from a physical. How do you determine what somebody's capable of? Like, what is your frame to think about that?
Well, you have to start somewhere, and you have to have great testing in place, and yet you have to be willing to call BS. There's a lot of people that tell you that they're good at something, so I test them to see whether they're true, and that puts them under pressure, and then you can see whether it really fits or breaks down. But the first thing we do is we take them through an assessment screen, and we're pretty good at that. We, you know, the body works in an alternating pattern of, you know, stable segments connected to mobile segments. And that's how we were born. That's just the human body. We're all the same in that structure, pretty much. And so, you know, what we do is we look at that and see if that structure's in place. If it's not, then it's going to be a little more difficult to get my job done. So I know from studying biomechanics, from working with the best players in the world, that to hit a golf ball 300 yards and to swing the club at 120 miles an hour, there's certain physical characteristics you have to have. And it doesn't mean you have to look like, you know, a muscly guy at the beach, or even that you have to look fit. And that's the big difference in golf, is golf fitness is way different from looking good on the beach. You know, there's a lot of guys that may not look physically fit, but their body functions exceptionally well for swinging a golf club or the way they swing a golf club.
And is that the average for a man, a male swing, 120?
I mean, no, that's PGA Tour.
PGA Tour. Yeah. Okay.
The average customer, you know, if they're swinging over 90 miles an hour, you know, that would be probably more average, between 90 and 100. PGA Tour is 110 to 120. And, you know, college is close to 110, 115. So, you know, the young kids are actually getting faster and faster today.
Mm. What is the average club speed for the LGPA?
The LPGA Tour, they basically, you know, around 90, 92. So in many, many ways, the average country club male should really be looking at statistics from LPGA girls because they've got smaller frames. You know, they don't quite have the stature that maybe a man does, but they're able to create a lot of speed with their frame. So a lot of times I'm like, you need to really look at LPGA numbers and see what the girls are doing, and you can learn a lot from them based on what you need to do.
How does your average customer relate to that when you say, hey, listen, you shouldn't compare yourself to the best in the world in your gender, but you should actually look at, you know, what women are doing because you're closer to that as a norm? How do they respond to that?
You know, not great. I don't think anybody likes to look at it that way. I don't really present it that way. I know it to be that way, but what I try and do is find a swing that fits you. So, you know, depending on who you are, so on how much time you're going to give me and what your dedication is to the sport. You know, I think that golf's an amazing game. I mean, I've toured a 2-year-old and I've toured a 92-year-old. You know, the other huge thing with golf is it covers so much. I mean, you know, what sport do you change the playing field every week? You know, there isn't one. we go out on different golf courses, the circumstances change every week. It's not like going to the tennis court. Tennis court's a tennis court. So the mental and emotional facts that have to go on and the physicality of swinging a golf club, the body just isn't really meant to do that. So there are a lot goes on in swinging a golf club, you know.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that have attracted me to adventure sports such as surfing is that the surface changes on each wave, and certainly each contest in the pro ranks, every wave is different. Every type of wave is different, but even more nuanced there in surfing is that every wave is different. And so getting good at let's just talk about surfing for a minute, is really challenging because it's hard to repeat in standardized conditions. And the amount of time that somebody's actually standing on a surfboard is limited. And so figuring out how to maximize paddling and all the other necessary components to surfing is a competitive advantage. And I'm sure that you're using something similar to that in golf, is that it's not necessarily just the swing, but it's all the things around it that can help maximize growth.
Yeah, so, you know, we look very much at fundamentals. I mean, there's a basic set of fundamentals. They're moldable depending on how that body works. So, you know, obviously there's a certain way to stand up to the golf ball. There's a certain way to grip the club that's going to be most effective. There's a certain way to move away from the golf ball to move down. But if you try and put that in front of somebody, which happens when you're a young instructor and you first start, you want to give everybody everything, you know, and it's not until you get older that you realize that that's just going to confuse the issue because, you know, you just can't think of all these things when you're trying to hit a golf ball. So, you know, that's the danger.
Yeah. Is that how you approach teaching, is that you start with the base, the feet, and then you move up? Or...
Yeah, so I always look at it like it's the foundation, you know, for it's like a foundation on a house. So you've got to build a structure. So you've got to make somebody aware that if I put you in this position, it will help you create a consistent pattern of motion. But there's not one position. There's a unique position for everybody based on how you're physically put together, you know. But there are some basic fundamentals that I'm looking at, from the stance, their posture, their body position, because it just helps make it easier. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the base. That's what you look at.
Okay. I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, with chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out.
Okay. So let me see if I got this right. So you want to first begin with assessing what a person's capable of, and then you look at their unique physiological structures, like they might have one hip that's higher than the other, or one poor rotation in the left shoulder compared to right. And then so from that, then you give them some basic framework physically to work from, which is feet, posture, and maybe grip and hands, something along those lines.
Yeah, so I always give everybody two options. You know, once I've done my evaluation, I can either build you the golf swing you want, but it might mean me bringing in my team of fitness experts and medical experts to rebuild you. It's kind of like taking a classic car and rebuilding it from scratch, you know. Or I can just teach you how to take that kind of classic car and drive it pretty fast around the track if we do a few modifications. We might have to steer it a little bit to the left, or we might have to pump the tires up a little bit on this side. So you give everybody two options. And you know what's amazing is you would think that most people would say, oh, I just teach me how to steer the car. But most people go, no, given two options, they want to rebuild the car, which shocked me, actually.
Yeah, that is shocking because that requires an incredible amount of work. But to me, it speaks to that what you're just shared with me is that most people want to be optimal. They don't just, right? They want, okay, that's interesting.
And this is why it's so important to educate your consumer, which I think great coaches do really well, but I think in many cases people miss the boat, is that, you know, we're in a world of technology today where people don't learn, they just scan. They scan emails quickly. I mean, think about how our lives have changed in the last 10 years or so, and with mobile devices. And it's incredible. You can see a lot of things, but I don't know how much they actually learn. So I'm big at really educating the consumer, because I think the consumer, the educated consumer, is the best consumer. The one that's given the options, it's logical. You're going to look at it and go, well, geez, that makes more sense. Why wouldn't I do that, you know?
Okay. And so with this education process, you mentioned a word about giving them a better awareness. Mm-hmm. And so I've got two questions related to this word awareness. Is that so first off, what you do is you give them a framework to test them and then teach a basic foundation for them. And then where do you insert psychology? Obviously, I've got a point of view on this. And then, how do you help teach them deeper awareness of where their feet are? And I mean that both like metaphysically, as well as concretely. And so, two-part question, sorry for the long way of saying it, is where do you insert psychology in this initial understanding of what a person's capable of, and then maybe even teaching? And then the second part is, do you do anything specifically to help people increase their awareness?
So I think psychology right out of the gate, you know, from when you first interview somebody, the questions you ask and the responses you get gives you a very good evaluation of just from their responses, you can kind of get what kind of a person you're dealing with just by the questions you ask. I mean, you're brilliant at this in what you do, and you're able to pull things out of people. I'm sure after you've asked your questions, you pretty much know a kind of something about the psychology of how this person goes about explaining. And I think we do the same thing. So I think that starts right out of the gate. I think the psychology, when you get into golf, you've got to have a certain level of ability. And you've got to keep them in the game. So, you know, there's these building blocks to success. So a beginning golfer, it's not easy. They're going to struggle out of the gate unless you put these pieces of the puzzle in the right way. If you put them in the wrong way, they're going to get confused and upset. So it's this constant kind of mixing and moving and showing. And I use a lot of mirrors and, you know, a lot of feel. How did that feel to you? And that's what I've learned from motor learning, you know. And we've got two of the best motor learning experts in the world on our advisory board that have talked to us about how people learn. And when you can take that information and put it on somebody, it becomes very, very powerful if you know how to do it, you know?
Yeah, that, okay. So I'm sure you are astute and deeply listen to the responses that people give you. And knowing that you have somewhere near 17,000 coaches that you've certified,
yeah.
Do you walk them through how to listen and how to pay attention to what the person's maybe basic psychology is looking like?
Yeah. So, you know, we have different levels of our certification. So level one is kind of fun because it's 2 days and there's some online pieces as well. But basically, you know, there's medical professionals, fitness professionals, and golf professionals all in the same room, because I'm big on building a team, is that, you know, you're so much stronger when you can do that and you can share each other's experiences. So if I'm trying to fix somebody's posture, but their pelvis won't move properly, then I might need strengthening. I might need to get their glutes engaged, or I might need, you know, they may have scoliosis, and I need to be aware of that from my medical doctor. So during our level one, I think we start the psychological process of how you answer the questions, how you talk to somebody, how you make them feel comfortable, because that's the key, is that people have got to feel a sense of comfort when they come for a coaching session. You don't want someone to feel, oh, you know, this is kind of uncomfortable, because they won't give you what I need to make them better, you know?
Yeah, I think that so this is how we would do it. If, like, there's a psychologist involved in it, is that we would listen deeply, but we're putting those answers into a framework as well.
Yes.
And so there's, you know, there's like ways to think about this, which is, are they open? Are they conscientious? Are they driven for external rewards versus internal rewards? Are they extroverted, introverted? Are they risk taker or rule follower? Like, there's these frames that you can put people, their basic responses in, to learn about what they'll do under pressure.
Yes.
And so that's the big one, right? Like, trying to understand what happens to a person. What is their psychological framework that they walk into the room with, as so that we can understand what happens to them, or maybe predict, or have a guess of what would happen to them under pressure. And it's that's the art of this, right? Is like figuring out what is your likely response set when you start to either interpret pressure's coming, which can feel like, yeah, exactly like, you know, there's real pressure, or when you're in the middle of it and, you know, do you fight your way through it, or do you want to move yourself away from the perceived danger? And that's me thinking about, I don't know if you can use any of that. It's kind of esoteric.
No, it is. It is. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've used psychological profiling on our elite level players. In mm-hmm. fact, we do it with their caddies. We do it with their team, because I want to know, okay, is this caddy the right support caddy for this player? So, you know, at the elite level, I mean, these guys are playing for millions of dollars, as just like any elite level athlete these days. And, you know, to get the right team together, the caddy can be a huge supporting role. I mean, they're out there. They're the only one out there in the course of play under pressure. They see things that even the coach doesn't see. So that relationship today is bigger than anything, and you need to put those profiles together and see who would work well together and who won't. You know?
I think it's one of the more powerful influencers for the golfer on the day is that relationship and the way that they nudge and challenge and nudge and challenge and support. And can I run something by you really quickly?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're in the business of creating coaches.
Yes.
And I'd love if you could bounce off of this idea for me, is that the way that I understand or define a high-performance coach is that they have insight, they collaborate with their talent, they support and challenge and teach and train.
Yes.
And I know it's a mouthful, but it's like one is like the elite, the true high-performing coaches is they just understand based on all their frames and experiences that they've seen in the world. They have insight. And yes. then they go on a journey with the person, and they value the person that's in front of them of their what they've seen and smelt and heard and experienced. And then they go on so I'm just curious if you can hit on insights, collaborate, support and challenge, teach and train.
Well, I think, you know, that you put it so well with those. I mean, I think collaboration is key, right? No one's going to get to where they're going to go unless you build the right structure around them. And to do that, you can't do it yourself. So I think one of the things that I'm good at is I know what I'm not good at. And that's probably the most important thing, is that I know with a player that I'm going to click immediately. It's kind of like doing a presentation in front of a crowd, and you can see when you've got the audience. You've got them. And you can see by playing the game, you know, we play baseball with an audience, and you're going to first base, and you can see that you've got them. And then you can see that one person that sticks out that you don't. And I think what a great coach can do is they're able to figure out how to either bring that person into the mold, and if not, they know how to get someone else on stage with them that can bring that person into the mold. And especially for us, because, you know, I'm a golf guy that's standing up there in front of medical professionals and fitness professionals talking about the body and how it relates to the golf swing. And then some of these guys are looking at me like, well, what do you know about the body? You know, but I back myself up with experts, and that's the collaboration side, I think, in every level. I think that the sequence of which you put things together is important, you know, especially to help somebody get to that next level. Everybody's a slightly different, but there is a sequence that works, and especially in golf. And we've been very fortunate to have so many elite players that we can test. And you can start to see traits. And it's really based on sequence of not only their motion, but of who's around them. And that's why, you know, there's lots of different people that you can bring into the fold. So, I mean, probably the biggest word is collaboration. I think to be an elite level coach, you have to have that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. All right. So on this, I want to see if we can get, if you can help me understand. I can't even remember how many countries you've been in or seen. I know it's a lot, but what has been to date your single most important or your greatest adventure to date for you?
Greatest adventure, just like in life just in sport?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, life.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, when I was in Papua New Guinea, which is a small island above Australia, you know, Papua New Guinea is still very, very unheard of. Most people kind of know kind of where it is, but they don't really realize that, you know, this is a small country. I mean, California is probably bigger than Papua New Guinea. There's 200 different dialects of language there. There's tribes there that, you know, up until 20, 30 years ago hadn't even seen, you know, a Caucasian person there. And I remember going there at a young age and doing this walk along something called the Kokoda Trail, which is where during World War II the Australians and the Japanese kind of came to head as the Japanese were coming down. And walking that trail and feeling this awe of things that I can't even describe, because, you know, people had obviously lost their life on this, and this was through the jungle. It was extremely rugged, and, you know, there were leeches all over you, and you were going through rainstorms and monsoons and mudslides, and it was just one of these experiences that you see in a movie, and you were living it, you know. So to me, that was this incredible time in my life. And I've seen a lot of things. And growing up in Africa, I've seen some incredible things as well. But it really gave me a sense of respect for people, you know, and the fact that you can learn something from anybody. I mean, we had these guides that would take us through the bush and find food, and you know, they would come back with potatoes and mushrooms, and you're like, there's no farmer's market around here. Where'd you get that, you know? And it's just, people are amazing. There are some incredible things that you can learn, and you can learn them from anybody. So that was an amazing experience for me.
How old were you?
Back then, I was, I think I was 13, 14. I was on kind of one of these, I wouldn't call it Boy Scouts, but it was kind of an advanced camp for that type of stuff.
Oh, that's incredible. So what's the name of that trail? I've never heard of it. So
it's called the Kokoda Trail. And it's, you know, there's some documentaries and movies about it. You can still actually walk it today, but you know, you'll still find bullets and pieces of planes and pieces of weaponry on this trail. And it changes every year because of the floods. And you know, New Guinea is a desolate place. I mean, it's very mountainous and it's very dangerous. I mean, at one time when I was there, they had an airline called Tal Air that was averaging a lost plane every month. So it was not a place you really wanted to get in a plane.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
It's pretty raw.
When you describe that, I've never asked you this question, but do you have a spiritual framework? Because what you just described sounded like it was a spiritual moment where you're connected to people that had lost their lives and the battle that was there, mixed with nature, mixed with, you know, an overwhelming, maybe emotional experience. And I don't, again, not to be dramatic about the emotion, but it was enough that you picked this story to share about one of your greatest adventures. And I'm just curious if there's a spiritual framework that you work from, if that was a spiritual experience, or you say, no, I see the world differently than that.
You know, I think we're all spiritual. I wouldn't say I'm Christian. I wouldn't say that I'm a practicing Christian where I go to church every week, because I don't. But I have at times gone, and I have my own belief that there's a higher power. And the reason for that is because I've had a unique experience. I've lived in a lot of countries and seen a lot of different religions and a lot of different ways that people get in touch with their own feelings or their own higher power. And so I believe that, you know, there is somebody above us checking us out. There's too many situations in life that happen that you can't explain, and then you sit back. And I've had some very eerie experiences throughout my life where I've sat back and said, there's somebody else looking out for me, you know?
With all of the religions and spiritual practices that you've seen, like firsthand, why did you choose Christianity? And this is not a critical question. This is like really curious.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I chose it. I think it chose me. So
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just one that, you know, through people that you meet. I mean, I didn't, my parents, I don't think they ever took me to church or anything. So I think I was always living in different parts of the world and being around different people. And I think I saw it more as the way that I wanted to live my life, you know?
Mm-hmm. And do you see that God for you is active or passive? Is he guiding life experiences, or is it passive, like he set the ball in motion and said, okay, take a shot at this?
I think he's passively active. So basically, I think he sets the ball in motion. I've always believed that if the door is open, I'm going through it. And I'm not somebody that sits back and just waits for things to happen. I think you can make things happen. And I think that there's a lot of people that are willing to help you if you actually reach out for help. And don't be afraid to ask for help. There's a lot of people that are.
Would you say that that's like one of your guiding philosophies in life, is that to go for it in that exact way that you just described?
Yeah, I do. I do. Because, you know, I think back to how I got to where I am today. And, you know, I've made the sacrifices, you know, away from my family. I mean, you know, my mother and father are still alive. They live in Australia, and so do my brother and sister. And, you know, I see them once every 3 or 4 years. And yet, you know, I haven't had that family culture apart from my wife's family that's very close to me. Definitely.
Yeah. So what you and I have talked about this before about how much you travel. What is your how many miles have you accumulated?
Oh, it's like 2.4 million, I think. It's crazy. It's crazy.
and then you know, I travel obviously a lot as well, and you and I commiserate with this. I mean, it's great, and it's also overwhelming. And you've been married how many years?
I've been married 28 years.
Oh, wait, so what date was that you guys got married?
We were May 14th, 1988.
There you go. Okay, so I got married in 95, so okay. I'm close, but not as close. Yeah, but how do you, so when people hear of my travel schedule, and this is the question I have for you, they always ask me, as soon as they kind of get a sense of how much I'm on the road, they say, do you have a family?
Yes.
You know, they don't mean to say it in that way, but it's like, oh, I feel bad for your family. And it like, this is a struggle. And I've talked about this a lot lately, is that, and I'd like to learn from you, how do you manage the business? How do you manage the drive and the capture of what you have in business right now with the love that you have for your most intimate relationships?
Yeah, it is hard, but you know, technology today is better than it's ever been. I mean, who would think that you could actually get on your cell phone and go live video and talk to your family? You know, it's amazing. But I think that you have to have that support structure. My wife is an incredible person and very strong, probably way stronger than me. And I think that she's been a big guide in my life and support, and I couldn't be who I am without her. And then, you know, my kids are incredible as well, and that they found their own way and they're doing their own things. And I'm supporting them as much as I can. And I think it's important that when you are home, that you're here. And that's probably the hardest thing, is that when you're away, you know you're away, but when you're home, you better make sure you're here. And, you know, that's so important.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real-world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep. 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability. And up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a four-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there.
It's one of the things that I definitely is, that's exactly how I think about it, is be where my feet are, wherever I am. And wow. So the quality of that moment is impacted as best as we can. But there's times that even when, you know, we're doing something as a family, that something for business tugs on me. And, yes. You know, like there's something timely and responsive. And have you been able, so for me, my wife sets all of the standards in the home about the relationship between business and family by teaching my son, hey, listen, dad's gone for a little bit, he'll be back, and you know, this is what happens, and like just setting a normalcy about it. And I'm wondering how your wife does that.
Yeah, I think she does as well. I mean, you know, what she tries to do is kind of prioritize the importance for the kids and keep me in tune to, you know, this is a big deal for them and you need to be here and so on. So, you know, work will always be there. It's not going away. And, you know, everybody's busy in life today. We all have things that we're doing. And you really need to prioritize what is important because, you know, the 8-to-5 job today, it doesn't need to be that way. I mean, I can wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and get more done in the first hour and a half of the day than I can sitting in an office where people are interrupting me for 8 hours a day. So I look at it, though, you know, if they've got a tennis match or, you know, my son's a competitive dancer and singer, and if he's performing, I'm going. And if I'm home, I'm going. And if it's at 3 o'clock or, you know, it's 11 o'clock and I need to be at their school, I'm going. So,
you know what? That's exactly what I'm doing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to put the priorities there, and there's nothing more important than family. And, you know, I've been fortunate that I have an incredible family on my wife's side and my family in Australia, who obviously I love, but it's a different world we live in. And, you know, I can't be there every day. And I think the other big thing to do is friends. And friends today can be extremely powerful, and you need real friends and not Facebook friends, you know, that just, you know, Facebook friend me, that you don't know who they are. You know, everybody has that series of 8, 10, 12, whatever it is, real friends that you can pick up the phone and talk to, that are there for you, that can help you, that can pick your kids up, that can be there when you're not there. You need to find that.
Yeah, and you've been probably, you and your partner, Dr. Greg Rose, have probably been the most influential people for the next generation of golf. Like, I don't know of another company or agency that has credentialed or influenced the thinking around performance for golf as you guys. And maybe I'm wrong and I just don't know of other people, but that's how I think of you.
Yep.
In that pursuit, what has been the biggest cost for you? This is the dark side, right? Like, what is the biggest cost for you pursuing your way of living?
Well, I guess at first it was missing family and missing some of the things for the kids, you know. But I think that in order to be, you know, Einstein, I think, said that this quote many years ago, and it was, you know, only one who devotes himself to a cause with his whole strength and soul can be a true master. For this reason, mastery demands all of a person. So if you really want to be, if you really want to be the best, if you really are passionate about something, you're going to need to know that you're going to have to give it your all. And unfortunately, there are going to be consequences for that. And you've just got to know how to manage those consequences. But if you're giving it at all, you'll figure it out.
You know what would come up for me often was when I would work with people in adventure sports that are doing really the most dangerous things or working in the most dangerous environments, is that others, when I would describe some of the projects that I'd be working on or the feat that somebody was trying to go for or test themselves, the response would be this: God, those people are crazy. And it's what they've done, though, is exactly what you just touched on, is that they've had a vision, they've had an idea, they crystallized it, and they gave all of themselves to it.
Yeah.
And I think that people call that crazy. And you've done that. And you've done it maybe in an environment that isn't physically dangerous. This is one of my things about golf, is that, you know, like, there's no physical danger if you don't perform well. It's more ego and money that's on the line. Those are the two. I'd love to hear your take on it. But it sounds like you've done that same exact thing, is that you've chipped all in, you've brought all of yourself into your craft, but then thereby you've influenced the next generation, and maybe five generations from now, of what golf will look like.
Well, I think we have. And because we saw a void, you know, it was actually expressed to us by Tiger Woods, believe it or not. I mean, Tiger Woods was the first athlete, or so-called athlete, that really came to golf with a different perspective. So here was a guy that was giving it his all. And you know, he was the first guy that was talking about working out and getting stronger and doing mental, emotional training and sitting back and reflecting on his days and actually meditating. And I mean, this was unheard of in golf. People were like, why would you do that? I mean, most people thought that, hey, don't work out because you're going to get tight and you won't be able to swing the golf club. You know, and here's a guy that just changed the paradigm. And we saw that, and we kind of jumped on it, in that we need to, facilitate a network of people that have the right information. And if we do that and we push that out there, it will filter down to the average player. So what we've learned from dealing with the best, we've been able to take that all the way down. And really my passion today is kids. And you know, unfortunately in this country, you know, 70% of kids quit their sport by the age of 13. And, you know, every sports participation is declining, and it's declining because of a lot of reasons, but a lot of it is coaching. It's that the coaching isn't there. It's not understanding what they're going through today. And we need to change that, you know. Mm.
So knowing what you know now, if all of the pros that you've worked with, the people that you've certified and coached, and the number of golfers that you've touched as a businessman and also as a craftsman, what guidance would you hope that the next generation gets right? But both for more so than golf, but what do you hope that the next generation gets right?
You know, I think you've got to, wow, there's a couple things there. I mean, that's a deep one. I mean, you got to perform without the fear of failure. You know, I think that most people are scared to take the jump and the leap. I see this a lot, in that they're scared to make a mistake because there's a camera on them, or there's people on them, or what have you, and they don't want to.
Isn't that amazing?
That they want to screw up.
Yeah. So this is something I'll talk about, that I think we all have a fundamental decision in our lives, which is either to approach success or avoid failure. And most people, I think, have this model of a fear of looking bad, which is avoiding failure.
Totally.
And so you're using golf, and you're hoping that what they get right is not a better swing, but a better psychological model.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what I'm trying to do is put all the pieces together, and then, you know, listen, everybody's going to make their mind up. But if it's based on scientific fact, which we have thousands of golfers' data, and it's based on a successful approach by looking at everything and having an advisory board that's got your back when you don't know or tells you you're wrong, then you can start to whittle down and come up with a plan of attack that will really change something. And we're not scared to fail. I mean, I've turned great golfers into good golfers, and I've turned good golfers into great golfers. I failed, you know, many times, but I've never been scared. And, you know, I've apologized, and I've tried to put them on the right track, and it might have been sending them to another coach or sending them a different pathway. But if you're scared to fail, you'll never really commit, you'll never really put yourself out there, and you'll never get to where you ultimately want to go.
That it sounds so trite. you know, and I don't think it is at all about the importance of letting it rip and going for it and bringing everything into it and seeing where it goes and being a really curious observer to learn and figure out what your potential looks like, to really take a stab and step into something and bring all of you. It sounds so kind of like, I don't know, it should be on a postcard somewhere, but
it probably is.
Yeah, probably lots of them. And, yeah. You know, but so how do you help people? I've got lots of ways I think about it, but I'd love to hear how you help people, you know, stand up and take a shot at life, either in a grand way or in a very particular, like, hey, I need to raise my hand at this board meeting because I've got an idea that I think could really impact the direction of my company, or to be an entrepreneur, or to say that intimate thing to a loved one that is difficult to say. Like, how do you teach this?
I mean, you build the right foundation. You surround them with people, you know, you build the right team to get them where they want to go. And whether it's an elite level athlete or just a junior that's starting, and that team might be the parent itself, and you've got to educate the parent. You know, most parents today are not educated. They're doing things to their kids that they absolutely shouldn't be doing. And if they knew it, they wouldn't do it. But we're so driven to help and to give a better life for our kids, that we want the best for them, and in many cases, we're not giving them the right things. So to me, it's creating an education protocol. It's developing a resource where it's tested, it works, we know it works, and a support structure around them. You know, it's the foundation.
So pass some of this insight on to parents. I think the same thing. If most parents knew what I knew about elite sport, they would probably not be pushing their kids.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, it's amazing. An article came out recently in Australia. The number one reason why a kid quits sport is the drive home in the car from the game.
Oh, no doubt. Well, and like, I don't know, in gymnastics and these types of sports where over-involvement is easy, golf certainly, and figure skating and single sports, basically tennis, the ride home, what I help parents do is have, like, do not talk about sport on the ride home.
Yes, exactly.
Talk about anything other than sport. But so what do you, if you could teach some parents about what you've learned, what do you pass on?
Well, you need to listen. You need to be really good at that. You know, it's easy to jump in and give advice, you know, but you know as well as I do, when you hit those teenage years, they know everything anyway. So you need to listen and try and help them make the right decision. So, you know, one of the things I think with the kids of today is that they need to make the decision themselves, and you need to support it either way. You can certainly step back and say, hey, I disagree with what you're doing. But it's your decision, and you know, you've obviously thought about this, and you this is what you ultimately want to do, then I'm there for you. But just so that you know, so that if they come back, you know, complaining and moaning, you can say, well, remember when we had that talk, I disagreed with your approach. So you've got to be, you got to put your almost business hat on as well as a parent. I mean, we're always going to want to dive in and help lift our kids up. It's just the nature. It's human nature to help people. But sometimes you actually have to let them figure it out on their own. You know?
And this, I think, this approach that I'm nodding my head, you know, saying that yes, because this approach gives people repetitions at failure at a young age when the cost is not dramatic. It introduces a little bit of pain and then introduces their them getting reps at dealing with adversity.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a little disturbed only because, you know, we're kind of in this culture today of, you know, I remember my son, this is about 5 or 6 years ago, when he was playing soccer, and, you know, I played soccer and I'd stand on the sidelines and I'd be yelling and parents would be looking at me like, what are you doing? And you can't talk at the soccer game. And then, you know, they would go, well, I'd go, what's the score? And they go, well, we don't keep score. And then my son would come running by and he'd go, Dad, it's 5-0. We're winning 5-0, you know. And he was keeping score. And, and you know, but we're kind of got this culture that everybody gets a trophy and everybody wins. And I think it sets a false precedent because life isn't like that. And more than anything, you know, they may go on to become an elite level athlete. They may go on into college and decide to do something else. But life, you don't always get a trophy. And you need to know how to deal with adversity. And when somebody says no, you need to know how to put that in perspective. you know, to me, in today's world, most people that disagree with us or say bad things about what we do, they're either uneducated, they don't know what we do, or they're threatened by what we do. We're saying something that they don't, you know, which gets back to they're uneducated. So you got to educate them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, giving people experience with adversity, you know, is the way to help them really figure out how to deal with pain and challenge and fear. And I'm nodding my head again, like, yeah, I'm right on with this. Okay. So on that note, if we just deepen this a bit on like your philosophy, is there one phrase that guides your life?
Wow. One phrase that guide, you know what? I don't know if there's one phrase, there's probably phrase. I love the feeling of being a child at play. You know, maybe that's not a guide for my life, but because I'm so involved with my kids, I mean, watch a kid at play. Go to the park sometime. Just watch them and just see the happiness and the fun they're having. And to me, I think what guides me more than anything is you need to be having fun. And it's a small word, you know, it gets back to my F words and it's a small one, but it means so much. And if you're not, if every day that you're doing something that you don't like to be doing, figure out how to get rid of it, you know, and maybe you need to take 30 minutes and deal with that a day, but then figure out the things that are fun and weave them into your life. It's so important.
Yeah. And you know, so the idea of having a philosophy really resonates with me. It's something that, you know, it's been around a long time, and some of the greatest thinkers in the world and most influential people in the world have a very clear philosophy about what they stand for. And it's one of the things I've learned working alongside Coach Carroll is that he's got a very crisp philosophy and he just lives it in every way that he knows how to. And so the reason I'm sharing that is that fun, if that's like the center word that kind of cuts to it for you, as soon as as a businessman, you're challenged with a big deal or you're challenged with an opportunity that could be very difficult when you've got to make a critical decision, mm-hmm. like I would imagine that what you do is you go, yeah, okay, this is getting good now, as opposed to, I have to do what? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's like pressure, right? So it's like feeling pressure or feeling nervous. I mean, that to me tells me that something's good is happening. Mm. So, you know, because if you're nervous, that means that you've put yourself in a situation that something cool is about to happen. I don't know what it is. I'm kind of nervous, but if I go with this and just let it happen, something good's going to happen. So in business, you know, every day we deal with different things. And as we grow and as we, you know, we're getting into other sports other than golf and so on, if it's not fun for me to do, then I've got someone on my team that I know would love to do that.
Yeah, there you go. I love that. That is awesome. Okay, I would just challenge you on one thing if I could be so presumptuous. Yeah. That the word nervousness, when you start to feel like butterflies or sick to your stomach or that little kind of edge in muscle twitch and shake and that tremor and your breathing changes, your heart rate goes up and all that. I think that's what you're likely referring to as nerves, but that's not nerves. It's just that your body is switched on a bit.
Yeah.
And if you don't label it nervous and you just say, yeah, look at that. My body switched on. All right, cool. So that's one of the frames that I help people kind of reinterpret what is happening with their body. When your body switches on, you get to say, all right, I'm in it now. Yeah, here we go.
That's really cool.
Yeah. All right. So is there one word that cuts to what you understand best?
What I understand best.
Or what you do the best.
I think what I do the best is listen. I think I'm really good at that. And that was probably partly, you can drill that back to when I was a kid, in that, you know, I had to listen. I had to be aware of my surroundings. I had to know who was in the room and at every point. So I would say I have great focus in terms of not intense focus on one thing, but maybe perspective focus. I see things as a 360. I'm able to kind of separate myself, detach myself from the moment and see it from a bigger perspective. I think that's probably what I do best.
Ooh, how'd you develop that skill?
You know, from failing. Mm-hmm. I think from learning from mistakes, but not being afraid to try something. I think that you see this every day on tour. I mean, I think about Jordan Spieth has had this incredible year, this young player. I mean, 22 years old and he won $20 million this year. I mean, it's just amazing. And, you know, they had a video of him a couple weeks ago where they show him talking to the golf ball and kind of yelling at himself. And they put all this confirmation together and it's, oh, Jordan and this and that. And in many ways, that's what I saw there is I saw he was able to pull himself out of this incredible pressure moment, give himself a little yell and then get right back in. And it was so cool to watch. And I remember that from Tiger. You know, Tiger in the era, the early 2000s, when he just dominated this game so well, he had this temper and he would have this little tantrum, but only for 30 seconds. And it was almost a way to detach himself from the moment, see what's going on, and then jump right back in. And there's been instances throughout golf that that's happened. And there was a guy called Michael Campbell who won the U.S. Open many years ago. And with three holes to go, he was a nervous wreck. And he would run into the port-a-john, and everybody thought he was going to the bathroom. But he was actually taking his finger out in front of him and bringing it, watching it come to his nose to centralize his focus. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many strategies to kind of, you know, release and regroup. There's so many that we can do. But the idea of having awareness that it's time to release – and then a strategy to regroup is really cool.
Yeah. And I think, don't elite teams do that? I mean, obviously, Seattle does that. I mean, I think some of the Navy SEALs that I've talked to and listened to, they seem like they're experts at that. I mean, with what they have to do in life and the decisions they have to make, their ability to be able to see things that others don't is just incredible.
Okay. So as one of the biggest movers in the industry of golf for preparing and performance, and when you were a kid, you were hungry to be part of the group and maybe be better than others. And then you flipped your model to really help people be their best, whatever that is. What are you hungry for now in life and in your craft? What are you most hungry for?
Wow, that's a great question. I think I'm most hungry because I feel like I'm only just getting started.
Oh my God, isn't that fun? Look at what you've done already.
It really is. I don't think I've even started. You know, I look back at golf and, you know, we've got this incredible group of men and women around the world that are out there, you know, and we've developed tools for them to be better at doing what they do and to go out and golfers and so on and help golfers. And I'm going, we are just right at the edge. We're not even close to putting our foot forward yet because it really, think of sport and every sport and, you know, golf, we've created this certification of coaching. We've developed these junior pathways where you know parents can actually see where their kid is without telling them they're bad or good. They can just see what they need to do next. And that could be done for every sport. And I'm going, let's do it.
There you go. There's a huge opportunity right there in front of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really exciting to think about what the next 3, 4, 5 years is going to look like as we embed the Internet of Things and technology into the immediate feedback loop for people to be better and more aware of when they're on and off, both physically, technically, and mentally. This is I don't know where you are on this, but I'm so excited about what's possible in the next.
Oh, I am too.
Yeah.
I'm huge into technology. I mean, I look at a lot of it and, you know, one area that really amazes me is the science of the brain. And we're starting now to start to understand how people are thinking and how to trigger that. And that could be the biggest jump in anything we do.
Yeah. After this call, let's have another call because
yes,
there's some really cool stuff. Okay. So we've talked about your model about helping people let it rip and face down fear and not be so afraid. Is there a time when you realized what you were most afraid of in life?
I think I've been most afraid. As much as I say helping people get through failure, I've been most afraid of failure, of what, you know, of not being measured against my peers or not stepping up. You know, I think what spurred me on to that was, you know, when I was 30 years old, I got nominated as the youngest ever top 100 teacher by Golf Magazine in America. And I was shocked. I was like, my gosh, I can't even believe this. And, you know, they wanted to do an article with me and this guy, Paul Runyon, who at the time was an incredible teacher that I think he was like 88 years old. And it was almost like, you're not worthy. It was like the old you know, the movie, you're not worthy. And I was like, oh, wow, what have I done? You know, and now I've got to step up to this. And it was that fear of not being good enough or others thinking I wasn't, which was kind of strange, because you would think that when you get that, it would be like, hey, I've arrived. Look at me.
Mm-mm. No, that's not. Yeah, that's hasn't been my experience. In a previous episode with a violinist and a composer named Kai Kite, we talked.
Yeah, I listened to that.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that idea about the imposter syndrome. It sounds like it's a terrible phrase, but it captures that idea. Like all of a sudden you look around, you say, whoa, they're going to find out that someone's going to find me out now. And is that what you experienced?
I think so. Yeah. I think so, because you know I'd seen there was other teachers that I looked up to that were not that much older than me, and then that were a lot older than me that weren't on that list. And I was like, how the heck can I be there and them not? They're like my mentors, you know. And that was, that was a wake up moment for me that said, you know, you need to step your game up, and you need to prove that you are worthy of this.
So are you still operating from that place? Like I want to show people and I want to be better than others,
No, I'm beyond that now. You know, I think that there's a lot of people out there that do amazing things. In golf specifically, there's a lot of great teachers, but there's not a lot of great coaches. And there's a big difference there. And that is that, to me, we've got one of the only sports where the coach or the teacher never watches the student play. I mean, we give them a lesson on the driving range and we go, okay, have a nice day, see ya, and let me know how it come, you know, how you do when you go out and play for 5 hours. Now, what other sport does the coach do that? The coach practices with the team, they watch him play basketball. In Coach Carroll's case, practices all week, and then they perform on the field and he gets to watch them under play. There's a big difference there. So elite level coaching for golf, how to really help people get better is you need to play with them. You need to watch them play. Because you don't know if what you're doing is working unless you do that. You know?
Yeah, there you go. That's really cool. I think that's actually plagued the sports psychology industry quite a bit, is that traditionally, and I realized this didn't work for me, is that there would be an office setting, someone would come in, we would deconstruct and really have a deep understanding of what it would take for a person to let it rip and go for it and have the mental skills to be able to adjust and adapt to, you know, the stuff that they can't prepare well for, or that they're trying to prepare for, but you know, things always change. And then they come back, like, I don't know, a week later, 2 weeks later, whatever that time frame is, and describe it. And it's like, wait a minute, let's get our feet dirty together and see what that looks like when you're in the middle of it. And once that started to change with coaches and athletes and executives saying, yeah, let's bring physical, technical, and mental together, it feels like an incredible accelerant for people to improve.
I totally agree. Yeah. I think the mental has been missing for a long time. I mean, in golf, you know, there are quite a few people in that space, especially at the elite level. You know, there's a lot of people that will say that golf is 90% mental, and it is when you get to a certain level. But until you have the skill set to play at that level, it's difficult to say that to me.
Yeah. At the elite level, the artistry and the ability to compete at that level takes such a mental part of the game. Because everyone's physically and technically sound.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, right. They can all hit it 300 yards and they can move the ball every which way. So, yeah, that's the big factor.
So if we drive into your mindset, what is your ideal competitive mindset? Like what's it like when you're at your best?
It's unconscious. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that I think it can only occur when you're not thinking about movement. You've got to be into the moment. So I think anybody that performs at the highest level, you know, I guess I've had this experience a couple of times myself. I mean, I actually tied the course record at St. Andrews in 1995. I shot 63. And I had this caddy who was this great Scottish caddy, and he would just look at me and say, see that bush, hit it over that bush. See that tree, hit it at this. Hit it, and there's no trees at St. Andrews, but see that bunker, hit it over that bunker. He would just tell me what to do, and I just did it. Now, if I'd have walked up and looked at where he had told me to hit it, there is no way I would have hit it there. I just wouldn't. It was just trouble everywhere. But, you know, he had assessed my skill set and said, okay, you can do this. Hit it there. And that was one of these unconscious moments when I was just listening to him and going, okay, there. And he goes, yeah. And bam, I would hit it there. And I hit it unbelievable, you know. And I was like, how do you recapture that, you know?
Okay, so then as a entrepreneur, what does that look like now for you?
I think now it's having the right, I wouldn't say plan of attack, because I think plans can sometimes put you on the rails. And I'm a little bit more of a outside the box guy. I don't like to be in the rails. So I think in a business world, I think you've got to have, you got to have a picture in your mind of where you want to be. Like you've got to have that. And how you get there is going to change. So no matter what you put down in a business plan, whatever, you know, we've got a lot of strategists that look at financial plans and business plans, and they pull these numbers and do these spreadsheets. And you can't even bring me in the room when they're doing that, because I'm like, I can't handle that. You guys figure that out. But to me, you're just pulling numbers out of the air. Things are going to change so much. Now, I know why they need that. But I'm like, I need to be more of one of these people that has an awareness of my environment and where I'm trying to go. And then I go. And it's passion. I'm very passionate about what I do and what I want to get done. And that's what leads me. That's what drives me.
And do you write it down? Do you write down what that image or vision or...
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have picture boards and I'm a visual guy as well. So I think about photographs of where I want to see myself. I write things down. There was a great, you bring that up. There was a tour player recently that wrote on a piece of paper in his wallet, and he looked at it every day, and it said, I will be on the PGA Tour in 2015. And he did it. And he posted this on Twitter, and I was like, that's awesome. Every day he would look at that. He was driven towards that. How he got there, he just kept doing the things he knew he was good at doing, you know?
Yeah. Do you coach to asset, or do you coach to increase liability?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Okay. Do you coach, like, an asset or liability model for me is like, do you coach people for their to exploit their strengths, or do you coach people to get better at the thing that they're not very good at?
Oh, exploit their strengths.
Yeah, me too. It's like an easy question, man. I see so many folks that want to understand what's broken and try to fix that. And that just seems to not work.
Yeah, I mean, in golf, it's evident. You know, there's so many guys that go, you know, they'll start trying to fix something that they perceive as broken, and then they'll neglect the easy things. It's amazing how many tour players mess up a simple chip shot from just off the green, yet if you put them in a bunker against the face, or you put it in the deep rough, they knock it 2 feet. You know,
yeah,
and you're going, how is this possible? I mean, you know, here's this basic shot, and because they just don't practice it, they assume they've got it. And then under pressure, when pressure kicks in, all of a sudden, they haven't done it for a while. It is a basic shot, and they leave it 10 feet short or knock it 10 feet long, and, you know, see it all the time.
So how do you keep yourself so mentally strong as being, you know, responsible for the next generation of teachers of a sport that people deeply love? And having the financial rewards and risk involved in being an entrepreneur, like, how do you keep yourself mentally strong?
I feel like I owe it to the people that I've educated. In other words, you know, if I'm going to be an educator and put myself out there and train people to do what we've done or what we've learned, I need to keep learning so that I can keep changing that education model. And one thing I'm so proud of at TPI is every time we do the class, it changes. It's never the same. And the reason being is because we learn from everybody that's in the class, and we learn from every country we go to and every nationality we speak to, that there are different ways to get things done.
God, I love that. I mean, it's like you've just hit on a really strong human need is to belong and be part of something and to take care of others. And what a really cool community that you're creating and a position you've put yourself in to take care of others and to be the custodian for almost owing them your intelligence and effort and risk-taking and courage to continue growing. And what I'm just, when I hear that, I go, God, that's exactly what I've seen in teams that are amazing. Or even when it's 1, 2, 3 people or like large groups of people in companies or sport franchises, is they really care about the people they're around.
Whether
it's, yeah, like, and that's what, isn't that what we're trying to do in family too?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think in many ways, you know, family is everything, right? The structure. My kids, everybody's kids are amazing. But when I look at what mine are doing and the way they're doing it, I just stand back in awe. And there's nothing more I love than going to one of their games or one of their events and watching them learn and watch what they've become from 6 years old to my son's 13 and my daughter's 16 and watching the people that they're becoming and having a little bit in there. But really letting them go, letting them find their way, just steering them, guiding them as best I can, but not making the decision for them, you know.
Good job, Dad. That sounds awesome. Yeah. Okay, so in golf, let's see if we can – here I go again. We're in an hour and 15 minutes, like somewhere in that range. I love this conversation, Dave.
That's
so
cool.
So thank you. In golf, what are the most important mental skills?
I think in terms of mentally, you know, I think composure, if that is a mental skill, it's, I think, awareness. And I think in more than anything, you got to have belief in yourself, you know, and so many golfers don't. They're trying to be somebody they're not. And so I see that so many times with kids that don't get to where they want to go, especially good players. You know, I'm talking kids that are looking for a college scholarship or want to be the next Rory McIlroy or Tiger Woods. They're constantly searching and looking at them, but the ones that really succeed are the ones that know who they are.
Do you have a sense of how much people do for imagery on tour?
I think some guys are incredibly good at it. I think in general, most golf professionals are really good at it. And mm-hmm. The reason being is because it is such a visual sport. I mean, you're trying to hit a little white ball that's stationary to a target that's, you know, as far as, you know, hundreds of yards away. And, you know, there's obstacles in the way. You got to move it, turn it. You've got to be creative. You've got to look at the wind, the environment. There's so many things that come into play, you know.
So you use the word creativity, and you did something really creative, is that you built a business, and I'd love to hear this story arc as we're wrapping this up, but you built this business, you had a vision, you had an idea, you took a shot at it, you brought some people around that were really intelligent, and you have this way that you stay with it, which is to do good for others. And but you did this something really creative, is that you went to a title sponsor, Titleist.
Yes.
And can you tell, like, that's a business decision?
Well, it is. We were fortunate in that, you know, I, as a golf professional, Titleist is an incredible golf company, and the CEO of the company was, I think, is an amazing person. His ability to look at things that are happening on a big scale and bring them down to reality. When we presented this to him, he clearly saw the vision. In fact, he saw it clearer than we saw it. And the things that we were saying we wanted to do, he wrapped it all up and put it in a totally different perspective that actually blew my mind. And it's a funny story because, you know, when we showed him that this is what we're looking at doing, and he turned around and said, okay, I'll support you guys. I want to be a part of this. I think it's the future of golf instruction, and I'm all in. And by the way, it's going to help sell a ton of golf balls. And, you know, I almost drove the car off the road when he said that, because I was like, well, what do you mean by golf balls? I'm trying to help. You know, how does that work? And he said, you know, it's kind of a funny story. He said, well, it's really simple. You know, Titleist is a golf ball company. We own about 40% of the golf ball market. And the average golfer, when they play golf, they lose about 5 or 6 golf balls a round. So the way I see it, if you can help people understand the physicality of their bodies, understand how to keep playing this game for longer, then chances are they're going to keep losing golf balls, and chances are they're going to buy ours. So I'm all in.
Oh, that is so funny. That's awesome.
I was like, wow, you are really intelligent. And that was not the reason why I brought you into the conversation and I wanted you to do this. So in a roundabout way, it was an amazing thing. You know, by having Titleist as a sponsor, it immediately gave us credibility in the golf world. They're one of the big golf companies. And that was a huge bonus for us, is to have somebody support this at a time when most people were golf fitness. What is that, you know?
Yeah, there you go. Okay, rounding out here. Pressure comes from?
Wow, pressure comes from fear.
Fear of not being good enough.
Fear of failure.
Fear of failure, yeah. It all comes down to?
All comes down to family.
There you go. The crossroad for me was?
The crossroad for me was, wow, that's a good one. The crossroad for me. Crossroad for me was making the decision to leave Africa and come to America and not go to Australia.
That's cool. Yeah. So it was that seems like such a fundamental decision in your life to go to the big country.
Well, it was a huge shift because if I'd have gone to Australia, I would have been living with my brother and sister, which would have been hell. No, I wouldn't have been. They're great people. But it would have been, I would have been subject to what they wanted. I was the youngest and I would have been involved with their lives, not my life. So it was the crossroads. It was you either go there and live their lives and the life, you know, in the cities, or you branch out. You do something that no one's done.
Love it. Success is?
Oh, success. That's an interesting one. I think success. Wow, that's.
I know.
There's so many forms of it, you know. I think success probably to me is helping somebody.
You know what? I would not have thought that from you, knowing you, but because of like the world that you're living in. But after this conversation, I go, that fits.
Yeah.
That fits your model beautifully.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so last question before I before we kind of wrap up is like, how do you define mastery? Like, how do you articulate mastery in your life?
I think we've touched on it a couple of times here. I think mastery to me is having a great self-awareness. I think it's being able to perform or put yourself out there without fear of failure. And I think you got to go back to where you were from, your roots, and that is mastery is like a child at play. You know, they're not conforming. They're creating, they're doing things, they're happy, they're fun. I mean, just go to any park and watch a kid for a while. That's mastery.
I love this. And then how do you help people increase, what do you do? Better question, what do you do to increase self-awareness? Is there a practice that you have or a way that you increase your awareness of what's true for you?
I think you need to have self-time. I think you need to, you know, for me, there's a lot of it on airplanes. So, you know, when you're sitting on an airplane at 36,000 feet and you're flying around the world and you look out the window, you realize, wow, what an amazing place, world we live in, especially when you're up there. And I think it's a great way to reflect and look back at what you've done and what you're about to do, you know.
Dave, thank you. I've enjoyed this conversation so much. Like, it's been great. It felt easy. Awesome. It felt fluid. It was just like, just so good. And there's
thank you too. I have the utmost respect for you. I think what you're doing is amazing. And any way I can help, please feel free to call.
That's honored. I appreciate that, David. And so, where can people find out more about what you're up to?
You know, our website is simply mytpi.com, which is mytpi.com. And, you know, that is where we have information on our education. And that's more of a B2B. That's for golf pros, medical, and fitness. But for the average person out there that's interested, you know, find a TPI certified expert. Find somebody that we've trained to help you get to where you want to go. And there's some incredible people that can really, if you're in pain or you're, you know, you want to get stronger or you know, and golf is your passion, I don't think there's a better group of people out there.
Do you have any social media that you're using right now?
Yeah, so, you know, all the social media is on that site and, you know, it's just MyTPI. So you can find us at Facebook and Twitter and it's the same hang tag. It's just MyTPI.
Okay. And when is your next conference coming up?
Yo, I leave to go to Australia on Monday. So in Melbourne, if anybody's down there and they want to come, I'll be in Melbourne. Greg is on his way to England right now. He's speaking for the British PGA and then off to China, where we have three in China. So it's just, we're all over. But if you go on the website, you can see the seminars that we give and there's a calendar of all the events and where we're at.
God, I love it. What a game changer you guys have created. Like, this is just fires me up to say, okay, today, like, let's really roll up our sleeves and see what we can figure out in our own lives and craft, you know, inspired by what you've been able to do for the world of golf.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you.
All right, brother. Have a great day. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, okay. Michael.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. And the goal of this is to learn, and maybe we can learn from people that are highly talented and intelligent about what they do. And my hope is that we can pass it on, and we can just pay it forward. And we can, one way we can obviously do that is to share it with other people. And my hope is that you'll listen again if you enjoyed this. And the second is that you'll tell someone about it, either in social media or friends or email, however you do that. And, you know, just with all clarity, there's no money on the table for me on this. And this is purely a labor of love to be able to learn and to keep me sharp and connected to people that I respect and care about, and to be able to pay that forward and pass it on. So however you can pay this forward or move it along, I'd be greatly appreciated. And there's some pretty concrete things you can definitely do. You can subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already, which is on iTunes. You can go to findingmastery.net as well. And if you are so inclined, if you go to iTunes and then you find a way to write a review, it's a little tricky to get to it, but if you can take just a few moments and write a review, I guess that helps with the algorithm that iTunes generates to be able to keep us top of mind on iTunes. All right, so you can also follow some of my thoughts and stuff that I'm passing forward through Twitter at Michael Gervais. And we also have a Facebook site, which is, facebook.com/findingmastery. Okay, I hope you've enjoyed the work that Dave Phillips has spent his life to understand. And let's go kick ass. All right. Share it with your loved ones, and hope to be able to hear from you online. I hope you have a great day. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.